Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Imagine if some of the most fundamental proteins in your cells, the ones you thought you knew, like inside and out, maybe your metabolic enzymes, imagine they were actually leading secret double lives.
Double lives.
Yeah, constantly interacting with RNA in ways we're really only just starting to grasp. You see, for decades, we had a pretty clear picture. Maybe about 1,000 RNA binding proteins, RBPs, right? Key players in how our genes work.
Usual suspect.
Exactly. But recent discoveries have, like, more than tripled that number. And that fundamentally changes our textbook understanding of how cells are controlled. This isn't just about adding more names to some list. It's a profound shift in how we view the intricate dance inside every single one of your cells. How could these non-canonical RNA interactions impact basically everything, from how your body produces energy to maybe how it fights off infections? And what does this paradigm shift mean for the future of medicine?
We're about to unpack a truly revolutionary concept called riboregulation. Today, we're diving into some really groundbreaking work from a collaborative team. We're talking researchers from EMBL in Heidelberg, Germany.
Ah, yes. EMBL.
The Center for Genomic Regulation, CRG, and Universitat Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona, Spain. Their big review, it's called Rethinking RNA Binding Proteins. Riboregulation Challenges Prevailing Views, came out in Cell, June 2025.
A landmark paper, really.
Yeah.
It totally advances our understanding of this intricate dance between RNA and proteins. It opens up this whole new world of riboregulation.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit. For a long time, our understanding of RNA binding proteins was, well, pretty solid, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. We saw them as the dependable workhorses, you know?
Right.
Essential for all stages of gene expression.
Right, making sure RNA was transcribed correctly, spliced, transported, translated, the whole shebang.
Exactly. And they were known structural components, too. Part of big machines like ribosomes and spliceosomes. We had a good handle on them. We call them classical RBPs, about 1,000 of them in mammals. And we knew how they typically bound RNA high specificity, often using these specialized globular RNA binding domains, or RBDs.
Like little dedicated RNA handling tools.
Precisely. Think of them like a mechanic's specialized wrench, each designed for a specific RNA job.
But then things got, well, really interesting. Maybe confusing at first.
Definitely confusing. These new system-wide proteomic approaches started popping up, and they identified hundreds, then thousands, of new candidate RBPs. And here's the kicker. Many of these non-canonical RBPs didn't have those recognizable RBDs. Not at all.
Right. That was the first puzzle.
And even more surprising, they weren't some unknown proteins just waiting for a job description. They were often really well-studied proteins. Metabolic enzymes, signaling molecules, things with no obvious connection to RNA biology.
Yeah.
It was like finding out your car's engine could also, I don't know, conduct an orchestra.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
And yeah, this discovery sparked a lot of debate, significant concern even.
Yeah.
Because for many of these proteins, there just didn't seem to be a meaningful role for RNA binding. Why were they doing it?
Right. Seemed almost random.
Kind of. But this puzzling situation really shifted profoundly with this concept of riboregulation, the idea that RNA isn't just a passenger molecule or a target to be acted upon, but it can be an active regulator of protein function itself. That fundamentally broadens our perspective. Turns out RNA can actually tell proteins what to do.
Wow. Okay. So how did scientists actually uncover this massively expanded universe of RNA binding proteins? It wasn't just luck, right?
Not at all. It's down to some seriously powerful new omics techniques, really systematic discovery approaches. These led to databases that now list thousands of proteins, which suggests, surprisingly, maybe 10% to 20% of all cellular proteins can actually bind RNA.
10 to 20%, that's huge.
A staggering number. And the key enabling tech behind this is ultraviolet, or UV-mediated covalent cross-linking in vivo.
In vivo, so inside living cells.
Exactly. Inside living cells. When you expose the cells to UV light, this technique creates a zero-distance bond, a covalent bond, between RNA and any protein that's directly touching it at that moment.
Okay.
And crucially, it mostly avoids cross-linking proteins to other proteins, so it's highly effective at pinpointing direct RNA binders.
It's like taking a molecular snapshot, then. Who's touching RNA right now?
Precisely. A molecular snapshot. But, you know, it's important to remember that UV cross-linking can capture even very transient interactions, quick touches.
Ah, okay.
So the results need careful interpretation, especially when you're dealing with really abundant proteins in the cell. They might just bump into RNA by chance more often.
That makes sense. You need controls. So what are some of the specific methods using this UV cross-linking, these innovative ways people are pinpointing these relationships?
Yeah, there are several clever approaches. One common one is RNA interactome capture, or RIC.
RIC, okay.
That uses specialized beads, often oligo-DT beads, to pull down polyadenylated RNAs, the messenger RNAs, mostly along with any proteins that got cross-linked to them.
And then you figure out which proteins they are.
Exactly. You usually treat with enzymes to get rid of the RNA and then identify the proteins using mass spectrometry.
Right.
There are enhanced versions like ERIC using special LNA beads for even cleaner results. And you can even do it ex vivo on whole organs or biopsies.
So not just cell cultures.
Right. Which helps confirm findings from cultured cells and rules out significant protein cross-linking issues.
Okay, but what about RNAs that aren't polyadenylated, like ribosomal RNA or small RNAs?
Good question. For those, we have other methods. Silica-based approaches, like TAPP and 2C, are useful. They basically use the fact that silica binds RNA really well because of charge. So you capture all RNA species and their cross-linked proteins.
More comprehensive then.
Yes. And you can even tweak conditions to focus on small RNAs. But rigorous controls are absolutely essential here. Things like samples without UV cross-linking or treating with RNAs first to make sure you're seeing genuine RNA binding.
Got it. Controls are key. Are there other ways too?
Yep. There are methods based on differential solubility like OPS, xRNAX, or PTEX. They basically use the fact that RNA protein complexes behave differently in certain organic solvents like triazole compared to free proteins or free RNA.
Okay.
This lets you separate out the cross-linked complexes for mass spec analysis. It's quite an unbiased way to do it. And finally, there's RNA labeling-based analyses. These use special uridine analogs like 4-thiouridine or 5-ethinluridine EU.
EU labeling, I've heard of that.
Right. You pulse label newly made RNAs with EU. It has a reactive group, so you can click a biotin tag onto it.
Ah, click chemistry.
Exactly. Then you use streptavidin pull down to grab anything biotinylated, which is your labeled RNA and its bound proteins.
So you can see interactions with newly synthesized RNA?
Precisely. It lets researchers not only capture all RNA species, but also study dynamic changes in RBP binding as RNA is made or degraded. It gives you a time-resolved picture.
Okay, so these really sophisticated methods are revealing this huge number of, well, unexpected RBPs. But if they don't have those classic RNA binding domains, how are they actually interacting with RNA? What do these binding surfaces even look like?
Yeah, that's where it gets truly fascinating. We found that a substantial fraction, maybe surprisingly, interacts with RNA using other well-characterized globular domains.
Domains we already knew about.
Exactly. Domains previously known for things like catalytic activity or binding cofactors or even mediating protein-to-protein interactions. It seems like they're repurposing existing structures, existing tools, for this new job of RNA binding.
Wow. Evolution is clever.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And even more strikingly, nearly half, almost half of all the RNA binding peptides identified map to what we call intrinsically disordered regions, or IDRs.
IDRs, those flexible bits of protein.
Yeah, that's them. They lack a fixed 3D structure and solution, but they're often rich in positive charges and aromatic residues.
Which sounds perfect for grabbing onto RNA.
It makes them perfectly suited for transient, yet potentially quite specific, RNA interactions. They can sort of mold themselves around the RNA.
Interesting.
And we also see the Rossmann fold popping up frequently. That's a really common structure involved in binding dinucleotide cofactors like NAD+ or FAD.
Right, metabolic enzymes often have those.
Exactly. And it turns out that fold is also pretty good at binding RNA sometimes. It just highlights the incredible adaptability of proteins.
That adaptability is definitely key.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some concrete examples. These validated non-canonical RBPs and how they moonlight. Maybe start with how RNA directly influences enzyme activity.
Absolutely. A classic prime example now is iron regulatory protein 1, or IRP1.
IRP1. Right.
For decades, it was just known as a metabolic enzyme.
Yeah.
Cytosolic aconitase. It interconverts citrate and isocitrate in the Krebs cycle. Well, near it.
Standard biochemistry.
Totally standard. But it turns out it also moonlights as an RBT. It binds to specific RNA structures called iron responsive elements, IRES.
IRES, found in messenger RNA.
Yeah, but in certain mRNAs involved in iron metabolism.
Yeah.
And binding to these IRES controls the translation or the stability of those mRNAs.
Okay, so it senses iron levels.
Exactly. That's the fascinating part. Its two activities, enzyme or RBP, are mutually exclusive. And it's dynamically regulated by cellular iron levels. When there's plenty of iron, it assembles an iron-sulfur cluster and acts as the acetatase enzyme. But when iron is scarce, that cluster falls apart, the protein changes shape slightly, and now it can bind RNA and regulate iron uptake and storage.
That's such an elegant switch. Incredible.
It really is. A beautiful molecular switch controlled by iron, mediating an RNA binding event.
So is this enzyme thing common then? This connection leads us to that broader RNA enzyme metabolite hypothesis, the RM hypothesis. How does that fit in?
Yeah, it seems more common than we thought. Many other enzymes, especially those that bind mono or dinucleotide cofactors or substrates, think GAPDH, another famous glycolytic enzyme.
Yeah, GAPDH does everything, doesn't it?
Huh. It seems like it sometimes. But it's also implicated as an RBP, lactate dehydrogenase, malate dehydrogenase, thymidylate synthase. Others have been found too. In this observation, the idea that there's competition between the enzyme's normal nucleotide cofactors or substrates and RNA binding.
Ah, they might bind in a similar place.
Possibly. Or binding one affects binding of the other. This competition gave rise to the REM-M hypothesis. It basically posits that RNA, enzymes, and metabolites are all part of this complex regulatory network. They're mutually influencing each other.
So it's like a three-way conversation happening right at the heart of the cell.
That's a great way to put it. A three-way conversation where RNA can directly dial up or dial down an enzyme's activity, maybe depending on metabolite levels or vice versa.
That's a profound level of control over metabolism. Wow. But RNA's influence, it goes beyond just tweaking enzyme activity, doesn't it? It also seems to act as maybe a molecular architect, influencing how proteins interact and assemble.
Precisely. That's another major emerging theme. Take the selective autophagy receptor, P62, also known as sequestosin-1.
P62 and autophagy, right.
Well, there's a small non-coding RNA called VaultRNA-11 or VtRNA-1-1. It binds to P62. And when it binds, it actually disrupts P62's ability to form chains, to oligomerize, and that inhibits autophagy.
So the RNA acts like a brake.
Exactly. Like a tiny molecular brake pedal for autophagy. Hmm. And guess what? When starvation signals come in a trigger for autophagy, the levels of this VtRNA-11 drop.
Releasing the brake.
Releasing the brake. P62 is liberated, it can oligomerize, and it triggers autophagy, all controlled by this little RNA.
Incredible. And it's not just small RNAs, right? You mentioned circular RNAs and long non-coding RNAs too.
Absolutely. We're seeing that circRNAs and LNCRNAs can also directly promote or inhibit protein-protein interactions in the assembly of larger complexes. There's an example, circCC1. It binds to parts of the AMP-activated protein kinase, AMPK.
The energy sensor.
The cell's energy sensor, yeah. And circCC1 binding actually promotes AMPK activation when the cell is under metabolic stress.
So the RNA is helping activate a key signaling pathway.
Exactly. It's acting as a dynamic scaffold in some cases, bringing proteins together, or as a disruptor in others, like with P62, shaping these protein complexes and pathways.
So RNA isn't just about, you know, carrying the genetic message anymore. It's physically organizing the cell's internal architecture. It's guiding where proteins go, how they work together. This sounds fundamental.
It really feels that way. It seems to be a fundamental way cells control complex processes, even affecting basic cellular organization.
Right, how?
Well, RNA has also been reported to promote higher order assemblies, like actual physical structures.
Structures. Made with RNA.
Sort of scaffolded by RNA. For instance, there's a LNC RNA called glycolin NC. It seems to act as a scaffold to bring together multiple glycolytic enzymes. It forms a sort of metabolon, a temporary enzyme complex. And this metabolon formation stimulates the whole glycolytic pathway when cells are deprived of serine.
So grouping the enzymes makes them more efficient.
Exactly. And this is critical for ATP synthesis and cell survival under those stress conditions. We've seen similar ideas in yeast, too, where RNA helps glycolytic enzymes phase separate into glycolytic bodies under low oxygen conditions.
Phase separation, like those membraneless organelles?
Precisely. RNA is playing a role in organizing metabolic pathways and these dynamic phase-separated structures that are crucial for subcellular biology.
And you mentioned it even guides proteins, like to their final destination.
Yes. This was one of the really surprising ones. Cytosolic messenger RNAs, just regular mRNAs floating in the cytoplasm, have been found to act as ligands for ATP5A1.
Which is?
A subunit of the mitochondrial ATP synthase. the machine that makes ATP in mitochondria.
Okay, so the mRNA binds to it in the cytoplasm.
Yes, the precursor protein.
Right.
And somehow, this RNA binding actually facilitates the import of that ATP5A1 precursor into the mitochondria.
Get out. RNA is helping with protein import into organelles.
It appears so. It adds a completely new RNA-regulated layer to protein localization that we just hadn't appreciated. RNA is literally helping proteins get where they need to go.
That is mind-blowing, truly. And this whole riboregulation concept, it can even be, what, hijacked by viruses?
Indeed. That's another layer. During infection, for example, a host LNCRNA called LNCRNA-ACOD1 was found to bind to a metabolic enzyme, GOT2, glutamic oxaloacetic transaminase.
Okay.
And this binding enhances GOT2's activity. And guess what? This interaction actually promotes viral replication, both in cells and in mice.
So the virus is manipulating the host's RNA to tweak metabolism in its favor.
It looks like a clear case of viral hijacking of host metabolism orchestrated through RNA.
Wow.
And maybe even more relevant for therapeutics. Think about Triome-25. It's a non-canonical RBP. It's an E3 ubiquitin ligase, and it has antiviral activity.
Okay, TRM-25, antiviral.
It turns out Triome-25 itself is riboregulated. Its RNA binding gets stimulated by a drop in pH, like you might find near ruptured endosomes where viruses might be escaping.
Ah, so it senses the danger signal.
It seems to. This allows it to maybe discriminate viral RNA from cellular RNAs better, and binding RNA actually stimulates Triome-25's own ubiquitin ligase activity, helping it tag the foreign RNA or associated proteins for destruction.
That has huge implications, right? Especially for RNA therapeutics like vaccines or siRNA. How our cells naturally handle foreign RNA is critical.
Absolutely huge implications. Understanding how proteins like Triome-25 are regulated by RNA is vital if we want to design effective and safe RNA drugs.
This is all truly revolutionary stuff. But, you know, with such a massive expansion of RBPs from 1,000 to potentially tens of thousands, What are some of the critical questions? Or maybe concerns that arise? Like, why weren't these non-canonical ones found earlier?
That's a really important point to address. Mm-hmm. And the answer often seems to lie in the nature of these interactions. They can be highly dynamic, very transient, or they might depend on very specific cellular conditions, right? Like IRP1, only binding RNA when iron is low.
Right. Context matters.
Exactly.
Right.
Or like P62, needing that specific vault RNA. Sometimes, maybe only a tiny fraction of the total protein population is actually binding RNA at any given moment.
So it's hard to spot.
Hard to spot. Or maybe the regulation is more modulatory, like fine-tuning, rather than a simple on-off switch. That makes it harder to detect with traditional methods.
So it's more about the subtlety and the context, not necessarily a failure of past research techniques.
Precisely. And sometimes, if the riboregulation is exerted by multiple redundant RNAs, then standard genetic approaches like knockouts might give you false negatives. You knock out one RNA, but others compensate.
That makes sense. Okay, what about specificity? If these proteins lack those classic, well-defined RNA-binding domains, how specific can their interactions really be? Does everything just stick to everything else?
That's the other big question. And our high-resolution mapping techniques are giving us clues. They show major roles for those intrinsically disordered regions, the IDRs, and also the Rossmann fold.
Right, the flexible bits and the cofactor binders.
Yeah. And even though IDRs are flexible in solution, these regions, often rich in charged and aromatic residues, can engage in specific interactions. They might undergo induced fit adaptations when they bind RNA, molding to the RNA structure.
So flexibility doesn't mean non-specific.
Not necessarily. Think about IRP1 again. It binds its target IRE sequences with picomolar affinity. That's incredibly specific.
Okay, that's definitely specific.
While other proteins, maybe like ENO1, might bind hundreds or thousands of different RNAs, they still often show significant differences in affinity, maybe a hundredfold difference between their preferred targets and non-target sequences.
So there's still preference, even if it's broader.
Exactly. It really challenges our old, maybe too simple, notions of what specificity means in this context. It seems to be more of a spectrum. And it suggests that maybe RNAs have evolved over time to bind to these available protein surfaces, almost like how scientists can evolve synthetic RNA aptamers in the lab to bind to almost any target, even surfaces not designed for RNA binding.
Nature finds a way, huh?
Nature finds a way.
Okay, but could some of these newly identified RBPs just be, well, artifacts, you know, noise from these super high throughput procedures? It's always a concern with large scale omics.
It's a totally valid concern for any large scale method. And researchers in the field are very aware of this. They try to minimize artifacts through really careful experimental design, using meaningful specificity controls like the no UV samples or RNase treatments we talked about.
Right.
And increasingly, through multi-method validation, using different orthogonal assays to confirm the findings. Things like actually confirming direct RNA binding biochemically or mapping the specific protein regions involved.
So cross-validation is key.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we don't yet have a really high-throughput way to functionally distinguish the truly functional non-canonical RBPs from maybe just coincidental non-functional interactions. So for now, rigorous, systematic functional studies often guided by the protein's known biological roles remain the best approach. It's labor-intensive, though.
Yeah, sounds like it.
It really calls for careful, open-minded science. We need to avoid jumping to conclusions about function, but also avoid just dismissing unexpected findings because they don't fit the old models.
A balancing act. So this is clearly a rapidly expanding field. It's really reshaping our understanding of fundamental cell biology. What's the bigger picture here? What are the broader implications of recognizing riboregulation as such a widespread phenomenon?
Well, if you step back and connect this to the bigger picture, RNA is just. It's truly everywhere in the cell.
Yep.
We knew it carried genetic info. We knew it was part of machines like the ribosome.
Mm-hmm.
We're learning it's integral to these biomolecular condensates that organize cellular functions through phase separation.
Right.
And now, seeing that riboregulation, especially of metabolic enzymes, seems to be conserved between yeast and mammals, that it's common in actual organs, not just cell lines. And it's pervasive for enzymes that bind nucleotides. That's highly significant.
It suggests it's not just a few weird exceptions.
Exactly. It strongly suggests that riboregulation might actually be the norm rather than the exception, and that these non-canonical RBPs aren't some new invention. They might represent fundamental elements of cellular control that have existed since, well, maybe since the origins of life itself.
Wow, you're hinting at really deep evolutionary roots, maybe back to the RNA world idea.
Precisely. From an evolutionary standpoint, it's quite attractive to think that RNA's capacity to regulate proteins could be ancient. Maybe protein regulation by RNA predates complex protein-based regulation. Future high-resolution structural studies will be absolutely crucial here. We need to see exactly how these interactions work, understand the basis for specificity, see the structural plasticity of RNA in action.
Seeing is believing, for sure.
You know, we definitely need to explore all this much more in organismal context and, critically, in human disease. The review mentions that the frequency of mutations found in non-canonical RBPs documented in disease databases like OMIM is actually quite high.
Which suggests?
It suggests there's a solid likelihood of finding disease-relevant roles for these interactions, things we've been missing.
So this could genuinely open up entirely new avenues for medicine, especially for diseases where, say, metabolism or protein interactions are key factors.
I absolutely think so. For example, novel antiviral strategies could potentially target these non-canonical RBPs that viruses hijack or rely on.
Right.
And understanding the riboregulation of proteins involved in innate immunity, like Tyrion-25, clearly has implications for how we design and use RNA therapeutics, vaccines, gene-silencing RNAs, etc.
Making them safer or more effective.
Potentially, yes.
Yes.
Ultimately, really digging into the mechanisms of riboregulation, mapping the specific protein surfaces involved. This will undoubtedly uncover new targets for drugs and maybe even entirely new types of pharmaceutical approaches. The whole biology of RNA-protein interactions, as this deep dive really shows, isn't one where protein dominates RNA or vice versa. It's much more like an elegant pas de deux.
Goddamn.
A balanced, intricate dance right at the heart of cellular life.
Okay, so wrapping this up, what does this all mean for you, the listener? Our deep dive today reveals that RNA, well, it's far from being just a simple genetic messenger. It's a dynamic, pervasive regulator of protein function, protein complexes, and fundamental cellular processes. A surprising number of non-canonical proteins, maybe even enzymes or signaling molecules you thought you knew really well, are actually moonlighting as crucial RNA binders. And this leads to a pretty revolutionary understanding of cellular control.
Yeah, it's a fundamental shift in the biological paradigm, really. It suggests that many, many well-known proteins likely have these hidden RNA-dependent roles. They're orchestrating everything from metabolism to immunity through this newly recognized force,
right.
Riboregulation. Yeah. And this balanced interplay, this dance between RNA and proteins, it seems to be much more widespread and probably much more ancient than we ever previously imagined.
So the final thought maybe is, what does this really mean for how we approach drug discovery, especially when potentially so many common enzymes or signaling molecules might be subtly influenced by RNA in ways we haven't even begun to consider yet? Something to think about. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.